Cloudy, windy, and seasonal. Slight chance of rain. High of 58. Wind gusts up to 30 miles per hour today. So here are the numbers now. Wind southeast at 12. 50 degrees Kenosha. 48 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days that they are on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That rousing music is by the great British composer Ralph Vaughan Williams. It is Let All the World in Every Corner Sing, and it's the fifth and final movement of his piece called Five Mystical Songs. And this is just one of a number of great works that are going to be performed this coming weekend by the Choral Arts Society to kick off their 33rd concert season. And that concert, which is Saturday night, 7 p.m. at First Presbyterian Church in downtown Racine, is a concert titled Words of Wonder, Wit, and Wisdom. And with us today on the morning show, for most of this hour, is James Schatzman, who is Artistic Director of the Choral Arts Society. He's going to be talking about what is behind what is a very substantial and exciting way to begin their season, and we'll be talking about what is promised for the remainder of this 33rd concert season of the Choral Arts Society as well. James Schatzman, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Nice to be here.
Good to have you here. You were saying before we went on the air that one of the challenges in starting the season is just get everybody gathered back up and revved up and ready to go, and particularly when it is a concert as challenging as this one is. So I suspect the last few weeks have been very, very busy and taxing for you.
They've been fun, actually. They've been probably taxing and busy for the chorus. It's a very full program, but it's a wonderful program, which is really structured around the poetry. And so this concert has been built around great poets and some of their most famous works as set to music. And so choral music is always a literary form. But in this particular program, we're focusing specifically on the poets.
Say a word about how these seasons generally take shape. What kinds of things do you think about as you put the choral arts season together?
Well, I'm very fortunate to have a very gifted program committee, and we meet a couple times a year to kind of brainstorm ideas. And sometimes all it takes is one little spark to get an idea going. And over the course of the year, the chorus plans those programs out. I spend some time thinking about the particulars. Often one piece will come up, and it just sparks a whole new idea of which direction to go. And in this case, some of these poems have been benchmark for me. They've been touchstones for me throughout my life. Hmm. For example, The Frost Chew Something Like a Star, or the piece that you played, George Herbert's Let All the World in Every Corner Sing. These have been very important poems in my life. And the idea of building a program around great poets just seemed like a natural extension from that.
Absolutely. So let's give you a chance to talk about some of the great work that is going to be part of this concert that is coming up on Saturday evening.
Well, it's some of the poets that I'm just really excited, and authors that I'm really excited to present. We're going to do a Jabberwocky by Lewis Carroll in an arrangement by a guy named Sam Pottle, who I was unaware of until I began researching the specific poem. But he was a composer and arranger for Sesame Street and The mm-hmm. Muppet Show, and actually was one of the co-collaborators on writing the Muppet Show theme. Ah. Pretty gifted composer who I never heard of before. Mm. And so in doing a little research, I found some other wonderful things that he did. This is a delightful piece that people will really love. We're also going to be doing some poetry by William Shakespeare from settings of pieces from Twelfth Night and other Much Ado About Nothing and other great poems by Emmylou Deemer. And I don't think I could, knowing from myself, couldn't present a program like this without bringing a couple pieces from the Bible, which I think is a core of Western literature. And so we're doing a psalm setting, 67, which that was actually done for Princess Diana's wedding. We're also going to be doing a very dramatic piece by Norwegian composer Egil Hovland, Paul, for narrator and chorus and organ, highly dramatic setting. And so I think this is a diverse program that's really going to be quite interesting to listen to.
I suppose part of what goes into the specific selections you make is not just what's out there in the world that's cool, but what is my group capable of really singing well, or what are works that really fold nicely into their particular gifts or particular strengths?
Yes, you really do need to know your organization and present pieces that will flatter them and that they will be able to to carry off in a strong way. We've done that, and I'm very, very excited about the course, although we're challenging a little bit in this program, which is good. You want to be on the edge a little bit. You don't want to just do things that are easy. And clearly this program has some things that are not very easy at all.
In addition to what you've already mentioned, I think it would make sense for us to take a little time to talk specifically about the five mystical songs of Ralph Vaughan Williams, which of course are quite a substantial piece. I should think it's the most substantial work on the program in terms of length and so on, and also in terms of some of the complexity that it represents. What do you want to say about the five mystical songs?
Well, I suppose I'd like to start with George Herbert. These are some of the most beautiful poems. I mean, they were written to be sung. I mean, I don't mean that literally, but the poetry is so beautiful and so lyric. It just lends itself to singing.
It's like there's music before Vaughan Williams even got to it.
Absolutely. And Vaughan Williams was one of those people who was part of the movements around the world which are really focusing on the gems of their own culture. And Vaughan Williams and people like Vaughan Williams and Percy Grainger and Holst and others were really looking to what was some of the best of English literature and English culture. And the Herbert poems certainly rise to that point. as compositions, they're masterpieces. I mean, they're some of the most frequently performed works of Vaughan Williams. And this will be the Choral Arts, at least our second time performing these pieces on programs. I think one of the first years you were in Racine, you sang these works with us way back in 89 or 88. Our soloist for this particular program is Nicholas Berudian, and we're very excited to have him as a soloist with us again. But these pieces, again, they're one of those pieces I go back and listen to over and over and over again. They're just so rich in the lyric beauty that Vaughan Williams brings to it, and is really, I think, inspired by Herbert himself. Mm.
I want to make sure to give you a chance to explain something that people may have seen in the brochure, namely that Saturday evening is not just this 7 o'clock concert, but something else happening a little earlier that you're listing as pre-concert poetry between 6:15 and 6:45. What's that all about?
Well, we've invited, as a part of this program, the Poets Laureate of Racine and Kenosha, Stephen Calmer, who's the director of that program currently, and a former Poet Laureate himself, has invited Esteban Colon, the Kenosha Poet Laureate, and Kenyatta Turner, who's the Racine Poet Laureate, to come and share some of their work before the program. So this really is a poetic opportunity. And then during the program itself, we're also going to have some poems read by Gene Preston, Carol Lee Safiotti, and Stephen Calmer will be part of the program as it's laid out. So there will be spoken word as well as the sung word.
Excellent. So again, the concert Saturday night, 7 p.m. at First Presbyterian Church in downtown Racine is titled Words of Wonder, Wit, and Wisdom, with a wide array of wonderful poetry represented that evening. And this pre-concert poetry presentation actually beginning at 6:15. What a lovely idea as an additional treat that night. And, Jim, we should talk about the rest of the concert season first. For anyone just joining us, I'm speaking with James Schatzman, who is the artistic director of the Choral Arts Society. And their 33rd concert season begins this Saturday evening with the concert that we have been discussing about. Second in your season is something that has become one of the happiest of traditions with the Choral Arts Society.
I think, if I have it right, this is our 26th year doing lessons and carols. It's the we hold pretty close to the tradition that was begun at King's College. I think last year was the 100th anniversary of lessons and carols, and so you have nine lessons from Scripture that talk about the history leading up to a prophecy and history leading up to the Nativity. And after each reading is a kind of a reflective carol that reflects back on the text or enhances the text. And we will be doing those concerts this year at the Siena Center on the 15th of December and at St. Thomas Aquinas in Waterford on the 13th.
Ah, tell us about that church in Waterford. Have you performed there before?
We have. This will be our fourth performance there. We've done some subscription concerts there, and we've also done lessons and carols there for the last couple of years. It's a wonderful space. It's stunning. It's one of the newer worship spaces in Waterford, and it's wonderful acoustically. It's beautifully appointed, and the congregation and the staff there has really been supportive of our program, and so it's been a real delightful collaboration.
Hmm. So explain how much the Lessons and Carols concert changes from year to year over the course of 26 of them. Obviously, mm-hmm. It's not exactly the same. Is it ever the same? Are there certain things that you do quite often, nearly every year? Or how much variation are we seeing there?
That's a good question. The opening rite, kind of where the choir comes into the space, and has been pretty traditional for us. We've been singing Paul Monz's In Soul, Lord Jesus, Quickly Come for 26 years. Mm. Some other regulars we've done, often we've sung the famous hymn that's often begins, that always begins Lessons and Carols in England, and that's Once in World, David's City, although we won't be doing that one this year. We did it last year. And the rest of the program pretty much changes from year to year. I would say over 26 years, if you've gone to every one, there are some repetitions and things that you know. But we've worked in some newer pieces this year. We're doing a stunning setting of the Huron Carol, When in the Moon of Wintertime, which talks about the birth narrative in the context of a Native American framework. Very beautiful piece. That'll be new, completely new for us this year. Mm. And we'll also be doing some big English things by William Matthias, which are, to me, are just some of the favorites that we do, as well as some traditional carols. We've always sung O Come All Ye Faithful and Hark the Herald Angels Sing. They have their spot in our program that come back every year.
Very good. So, again, the lessons and carols will be presented twice. On that Friday evening, December 13th, at St. Thomas Aquinas in Waterford, and then Sunday afternoon at the Siena Center on the north side of Racine. So the performance this season I know the least about is the one that is coming up in March called The Spirit Sings.
Really excited about this program. This is going to be a survey of sacred music from chant all the way to contemporary praise. Mm. And so we'll have be starting this program with some historic chants and come through into the Palestrina era as we move into some of the more polyphonic works of the High Renaissance and early Baroque. And then we'll continue to move on through doing some Bach and some Handel, and then coming forward to the 20th century and moving right into the contemporary praise and worship. And so we'll have a full worship band there to sing with the Choral Arts Society.
Wow. So when something like this is that far off, is that concert, for instance, completely in place? I mean, do you have every single piece chosen for that concert in far off March already? Or do some of these concerts, in a sense, take shape along the way?
They do take shape along the way. And that program is probably about 80% complete in terms of the literature that's going to be in it. I'm going to be meeting with the worship band over the next couple of weeks to talk about specifically how we're going to build the back part of the program and how we're going to bring the chorus into that. And so that piece is still has some little work to do before it's tweaked fully in, but we're well on pace to have this done in more than enough time to deal with our marketing and chorus preparation.
Right. What intrigues me about that is that I think for a lot of people, their knee-jerk reaction to what gets sung with praise bands mm-hmm. is that we're talking about something that lots and lots of people really like, but in mm-hmm. terms of musical substance, mm-hmm. tends not to be there. It's often two chords, maybe three, and you know, and so on. So I think probably some people are going to be a little bit surprised that something like this is being folded into a concert by somebody like the Choral Arts Society that really mm-hmm. prides itself in musical substance. So I suspect you're having to really think long and hard about exactly how this is going to be worked into this program and what specific choices you're going to make.
I think musicians who have looked at this literature over the years have certainly seen that the composition and the structure and the gravitas of this music is pretty uneven. You know, there's wonderful things and there's awful things. I think we forget that even in Mozart's time, there were the Mozarts and there were others whom we no longer remember or care to remember. And so there is some really fine music in this genre that it's that really respects the text, uses it in ways that are meaningful. And that's the other part of this literature. Sometimes the texts are pretty poor. And mm-hmm. so I've really worked hard, and the team that I'm specifically working with is very gifted. Matter of fact, everybody in this worship team has at least a bachelor's degree. We have two people with master's degrees in music. They're very gifted, and they really and two of them have music degrees, and so they really have a sense of what is good music. What is music of substance? Even though it's set in a contemporary style, it should still have a strong text that actually means something, and it should have some kind of harmonic and rhythmic interest to it, and unity and variety. So we're looking at I look at structure. And I think I know when I hear something that there's just not much to that. So there won't be a lot of cotton candy in this program. It will be music that I think will move people and give them a good sense of some of the best that's being put out in contemporary music.
Very nicely put. So again, this concert is titled The Spirit Sings, and this will be on Saturday evening, March 21st. The Choral Arts Society back at First Presbyterian Church, such a beautiful space for making music. And that will be, again, everything from chant to praise band, contemporary stuff, and everything in between. Sounds like a really intriguing and wonderful program. And your season is going to end with a masterpiece that is, of course, a very, very grand and an intimidating challenge for anybody who attempts it, namely Karl Orff's dramatic cantata, Carmina Burana. First of all, say a word about the Choral Arts Society's kind of long relationship with this work.
This is a work that I remember the first time we did it, and I was looking around at our chorus personnel. I said, we have a unique time in history here. I have a terrific men's section. The choir's as big as it's ever been. This is a bucket list piece for me. Let's just give it a shot. I remember the program committee and board looking at me thinking, are you out of your mind? You do realize the scope of this piece and what you're stepping into. And I did. It was successful. We had a wonderful, wonderful experience of doing it. And one of the unique ways that we do this piece is in an arrangement by Orff himself for two pianos and the full raft of percussion instruments. And so it gives it a somewhat more transparent approach. I mean, the chorus is really front and center. Mm. And although I really have a love for the orchestrated version, I have come to really appreciate it done in this way, which just even in the biggest pieces, like the first and the last movements, the O Fortuna, the choir is just front and center. Mm. It really grabs you. The two pianos really gives a different sound and a very engaging sound to his very rich orchestrations.
Right.
And the other thing that's different about this work is that it, as it evolved in the way that we perform it, we've had the opportunity now to do this as Orff originally intended, as a ballet, and bringing in the Studio of Classical Dance Arts with Mark and Linda Darling to present kind of an amazing visual work, costumed, staged, full lighting and sound engineering. It's quite an undertaking for a chorus our size, but we're very excited to be doing this.
Wow. I wondered when I saw multimedia experience, mm-hmm. what exactly that was going to entail. Now, are the specifics of that still kind of taking shape?
No, those have taken shape. We have some of the visual aspects that we have projected images onto the back of the stage to create the scenes that you might be in, some abstract setting of a forest for some of the early pieces, some color changes and backdrops to create a tavern scene. As well as we have one, they call them a gobo, where you insert them right over the light where the big wheel of fortune is imposed on the back of the stage. It's very beautiful. Mark Darling really gets credit for designing these images and creating a space that's lit very imaginatively and has such rich looks to it. It's really amazing.
We've already touched on the fact that this is a big work. I mean, there's a lot to it, but I'm not sure we've really spelled out yet what also makes it musically such a significant challenge for any group that attempts it.
Well, there's lots of divisi, we call it. There's the parts are split all the time, so it's not just like four parts going on. Sometimes there's eight parts going on, and the drama of creating the right texture for each piece is really one of the artistic challenges. In that, some pieces are big and joyful. Some of them are big and kind of foreboding. Some of them are very thin, almost chant-like with almost no accompaniment at all, but pedal tones, just long notes, and then a chant-like melody over the top. And so it's a diverse palette to work with. It's really a challenge and a joy to be able to create a variety of sounds with one group. And then there is also a children's chorus. And you have this constantly changing colors. You've got a soprano solo, a bass solo, a children's chorus, an adult chorus, some pieces just for women, some pieces just for men. And so there's this ebb and flow of constantly changing textures, which was kind of a hallmark of the 20th century. I mean, even chamber music was becoming so, where Mahler would write these massive pieces, and then there'd be a string quartet in the middle of his symphony, or two on a part. You know, it's this diversity of sound matches up the diversity of the look that you're going to see. It is costumed. I believe, if I remember correctly, the ballet has three separate costume changes, and the children's choir has their own unique look. And so visually and as far as sound and as far as impact, you're just going to be on a roller coaster ride through an emotional landscape that's really a terrific ride.
Wow. And one of the things I remember about this work is how fiendishly difficult it is to count. That is what the kind of challenges that Orff throws at both the singers and the instrumentalists accompanying them is just fierce.
It is. There's so many times where the key signatures are complex or they're not the same. And so it's not like you park yourself in four beats in a measure and you can just go for the rest of the piece. Some of it is somewhat unmetered, and so there's no meter at all, and you just have to kind of pay attention as a group of a monastery would learn how to do chant over years. We have a couple of weeks to figure out how to sing together, how to sing chant that's unmetered. And so there's just a lot of complexity. But I think it's one of the things that I not only love, I think it happens to be one of the things that I'm particularly good at is communicating rhythm. And I've gotten that feedback from chorus members before that they feel very secure in how I present rhythmic complexities. And it's just, for me, it's really fun. It's I love harmony, but getting into a rich, complex rhythm, my blood pressure goes up and I just start to smile and I'm eager to dig in and get going. Mm.
So speaking of that, actually, when will the chorus begin working on Carmina Burana? I mean, will that not be until your March concert is over, or will you be sneaking your way into it from time to time even before that?
No, we'll be waiting until March to begin putting this together. And this is the chorus's fourth presentation of Carmina Burana over our many years of 33 years of existence. And so there's a core of people who know this piece pretty well. I'm not concerned. It'll be a heavy lift. It'll be hard work, but the chorus is going to be ready.
Very good. Very good. So that concert is going to be then the very end of May, May 30th and May 31st, Saturday night and Sunday afternoon, and that will be on the main stage of the University of Wisconsin Parkside. You've performed there, I don't think, very often.
Not very often, no. And that is where we did our last Carmina. It's one of the few places in our area. As you know, when you're looking at performances, there's just not a lot of performance halls in our area and ones who have the kind of space that's needed to put up an entire ballet set and house a chorus. And so Parkside's one of the few places that can really make that work. And so we're very excited to be collaborating with UW Parkside in that particular performance.
Wow. So 33 plus years ago, when you created this ensemble, which back then was not called Choral Arts.
It was, correct. It was Symphonic Chorus.
Right. Did you ever imagine that you were creating something that was going to be around more than three decades later?
I suppose it'd be naive to say that I knew it. but I really have had a vision for what I was trying to create here and what I wanted for our communities. And so building people around, from the beginning, I believe I was working to build this for sustainability and build it for legacy. And in the last couple of years, I've been thinking more along terms of succession. How are we going to allow this to move into the future beyond a founder, which for a lot of organizations, that's a tough place. I remember when Belcanto and Milwaukee went through that transition. It was a real tough transition when their founder and director, who had done some major projects with them and big pieces, began to retire. The organization began to lose some energy, and it wasn't for a few years later when Richard Hinson began to really dig in and kind of start building his own legacy. And so what I'm hoping to do is begin to look to sustainable funding for this organization as we move into its fourth decade, as well as begin to think about and structure how we can make a smooth transition moving into the 40th year and hopefully 50th year.
Wow. A lot to look forward to, a lot to be grateful for. And, of course, at the moment, we want to think first and foremost about the 33rd season of the Choral Arts Society of Southeastern Wisconsin and their concert, which opens this current season. Remind our listeners, Jim, of what's going on this weekend.
So this weekend, on the 19th, Saturday, at First Presbyterian Church, you're going to be doing a program called Words of Wonder, Wit, and Wisdom, which will focus not only on great choral music, but on the great poets that inspired them.
Very good. What should people do if they are interested in more information and or securing tickets for themselves?
Tickets will be available at the door, but you can also purchase tickets ahead by calling the Choral Arts office at 634-3250.
Very good. James Schatzman, the Artistic Director of the Choral Arts Society of Southeastern Wisconsin. It's always great to talk with you. Congratulations on all you've already accomplished with this wonderful group, and we wish you well with this weekend's performance and this concert called Words of Wonder, Wit, and Wisdom.
Thank you, Greg.
To finish out this portion, here is more of Let All the World and Every Corner Sing by Rayfon Williams. The time is 8:43. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and here's part two. We are spending the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show probing into one of the most frustrating mysteries of the late 20th century, namely the assassination in February of 1986 of Olof Palme, who was at the time Prime Minister of Sweden. one of the only times in recent history in which a head of state was murdered and there was essentially no suspect, no clue left as to who was responsible for such a terrible crime. One of the people who was most intrigued by this, troubled by it, and determined to get to the bottom of it was the well-known author Stieg Larsson, well-known, of course, as the author of such books as The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. It turns out that when Stieg Larsson died, he left behind him an enormous archive, which represented the extensive research and study and exploration that he had done behind the mystery of the Palme assassination. And much of what Stieg Larsson discovered, uncovered, explored, has been released to the world thanks to a gifted Swedish writer and journalist by the name of Jan Stocklassa. And he has released to the world, first of all, a bestseller called Stieg Larsson's Archive, The Key to the Palme Murder, and a more recent book now called The Man Who Played with Fire, Stieg Larsson's Lost Files and the Hunt for an Assassin. And I'm excited that we can have Jan Stocklassa with us to talk about this book and to briefly at least talk about his intriguing career, which has included a great deal of other work and an exploration of various conspiracies in the world of international politics. Jan Stocklassa, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's good to be here.
I learned such a great deal from reading your book about the assassination of Prime Minister Palme back in 1986, and I'm sort of embarrassed to think that I took so little notice of that event at the time that it occurred, and there is much that makes it, of course, very troubling. Tell us first, because you write about this to some extent in the book, about what Prime Minister Palme was like as a leader, and in a sense sort of his mixed image, the way in which he was on the one hand popular, on the other hand someone with plenty of enemies.
Yeah, Olof Palme was definitely the biggest statesman of Sweden in the 20th century, maybe ever. Some people actually said that he was too big for Sweden, and that's why he was also quite disliked in Sweden. Many people loved him, and the other half actually disliked him and even hated him, so there were campaigns run against him. And that was the same thing on the international scene. The small countries, the third world countries, they loved him because he stood up for them. The superpowers, the Soviet Union and the USA, they had troubles with him because he kept criticizing them all the time.
You tell us in a book, in a chapter called The Opposition, that Palme's political philosophy was referred to as the third way. Can you just say a quick word about what that term represents?
It represented that there was something between pure capitalism and pure socialism, that there was a way for the small countries of the world to actually to deliver a system that would help and take care of also of the weaker groups of the society, and that they could also stand up against the superpowers of the world. And that was what he was actually fighting for at the same time when the Cold War actually was coming to an end.
You tell us also that when it came to those who disliked him or opposed him, that as far as you're concerned, at least, it was not primarily his politics. You say it had a lot to do with his own background and also his exceptional intelligence that, in a sense, made him an inviting target. Tell us more about this facet of who he was that made him as intently disliked as he was by at least some people.
Well, he was from the upper class, and he switched camps. So he went over to and became the leader of the Social Democratic Party, the Workers' Party of Sweden. In that sense, he was a traitor of his class. So those, they didn't like him for that reason. When he came to his new camp, he was actually viewed as arrogant. He was extremely intelligent. He had an IQ of 160. And so he was actually one of the most intelligent and most well-spoken people. But he was also came out as arrogant in many debates and actually humiliated some of his opponents. So he became disliked in that camp too.
So take us back, if you would, to February 28th, 1986, and what we know, which unfortunately is not very much, about what unfolded on that night.
So it was a windy, cold Friday evening when the Palmer couple, Olof Palme and his wife, decided to go to a movie theater. And the late show started at 9 p.m., so they left home around 8 p.m. And called off the bodyguards. They entered the cinema, came out 2 hours later, a lot of time for someone to prepare, and then started walking home in this cold, windy evening. A few hundred yards later, a man stepped up and put one shot in the back of our prime minister. And before he fell to the ground, he was dead. Mm.
You tell us that it was not strange that the prime minister had called off his security detail. I mean, in effect, I suppose, sent them home. This was apparently very typical of him under these kind of circumstances, that he was often walking the streets unguarded, as it were. So in a sense, nothing should be read into the fact that he was not guarded that night. Is that right?
That's correct. He had been threatened for actually the last two decades of his life, and sometimes he wanted to feel like a normal citizen. And he also believed that in Sweden, a bit naive, he thought that he would nothing would ever happen to him. That proved wrong.
Absolutely. And of course, one of the most interesting things is to try to understand how not only the city of Stockholm, but all of Sweden was thrown into huge shock at this incident. One of the things that you describe in your book is what that scene was like the day after, when, for instance, Mr. Larsson reaches the spot where the assassination takes place. You say they were struck by the silence. 100 people were gathered around the little blocked-off area. No one was gesturing or moving around. No one spoke audibly. Those who were crying did so silently. It was a Swedish way of showing grief. People came, some with a rose in their hands, and people went, but it all happened in silence. And this happened, of course, with no immediate suspect in hand, and with every passing day it became clear that this was going to be a murder that would not be easily or quickly solved, and maybe would not ever be solved. Tell us about the extraordinary archive of materials that you were able to access that began the odyssey that led to this book. Describe this odyssey, where it was housed, and the sort of the dimensions of it.
Well, first, I love your description of it and the way that you described that actually moment. It was, I would say, that was the JFK moment of Sweden. Probably every American remembers what he or she did at the time. Mm. When JFK was killed, and that's the case of Olof Palme in Sweden also. Mm. So that's the thing, and the murder remains unsolved 3 decades later. And some 5 years ago, I managed to track down and realize that there existed a forgotten archive by our crime writer, Stieg Larsson.
Sorry, I was wondering, how did you know about it? Or how did you come to even realize that such a thing existed?
I was actually going to write a completely different book. I wasn't even very interested in our murder, in the murder of our prime minister. I wasn't very interested in the person, Stieg Larsson, at the time. But I was doing research, and I found a paper in an archive, and it said, talked about the alleged middleman in the murder of our prime minister. And I asked the lady who had the archive who wrote this, and she said, Stieg Larsson. And that was the inciting moment. That was one of those moments that changes your life.
Right. So describe kind of the dimensions of this archive, I mean, and the kind of materials in it, which you had to sort through and explore over the course of quite a long period of time.
Well, when I came there, it was this iron sheet door in a storage facility, rented storage facility, and I thought maybe there will be a small pile or a box full of papers. And the door rolled up, and suddenly there were 20 boxes full of documents, memos and letters and articles. And it felt like I stepped into a candy store as a small boy, and they just told me, you can eat anything.
Mm. Although you couldn't take anything away, at least initially, all of your inspection had to be done on site.
Yeah, that was it. I sat down there, and it felt like it was only 5 minutes, but I sat the whole day in this very sterile environment and just read and read and tried to find the thread that Stieg Larsson was following.
It seems to me that your book is, in a sense, about two different things simultaneously. It is the story of trying to unravel this really troubling mystery of who exactly murdered Prime Minister Palme and why. But it's also the story of Stieg Larsson's efforts to get at that answer. And in a sense, it's the same thing, but it's two different things. It's two different stories. And I think that's one of the things that makes this book especially interesting. Was that your intention?
Yeah, I think that anybody, Stieg Larsson and even I, when you start looking at, I use the word obsessed, when you get obsessed of something like that, it becomes your life for a while. And you stay in that bubble. And you can't stay too long. If you stay too long, you get crazy. And I've spent almost a decade on this, and now I'm going to the next story, you would say. So I think you're right. It's about the person also, very much, and the actual case.
And of you mention, I believe in the acknowledgments, that you never actually had the opportunity to meet Stieg Larsson himself, but you certainly have come to meet many people who were close to him. And I suspect even in the exploration of these archives, you have something of a sense of who he was and what he was like.
Yeah, I feel like I know him. I've sort of filled out all the gaps around him, so I see the picture of him. I know his living partner, Eva Gabrielsson, really well. We've become friends. And several of his friends also. So the picture is quite clear, also by reading his books now, but I just never met him.
Right. And a last question. We don't want to betray anything in terms of conclusions that you might have drawn, but you make it very clear that law enforcement has taken notice of this book and of the material that it contains, and you are really hopeful that someday someone will be brought to justice for this crime.
Yeah, the police asked me to hand in the book before it was published, and I wrote to them on the first page, here you have the manual to solve the killing. And since then, we met five or six times. They've asked to meet me, and I truly believe that this will be solved in 1 or 2 years' time. Mm-hmm.
The book again is titled The Man Who Played with Fire, Stieg Larsson's Lost Files and the Hunt for an Assassin. The author, Jan Stocklasa, this book available through Amazon Crossing. Jan Stocklasa, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your fascinating book, and best wishes.
Thank you, Greg. Good talking to you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you will hear my interview with best-selling author Tim O'Brien. He is well-known for a number of very hard-hitting books, and a number of them stemming out of his experience as a soldier in Vietnam. But he has not written a full-length book for some 18 years. His most recent book, very different from anything else he has written, a highly personal memoir called Dad's Maybe Book, which focuses primarily on his experience of becoming a father at the ripe old age of 58, the father to two sons. It's a beautiful book, and we had a long and interesting conversation about it, which you will hear tomorrow. On Thursday, we talk Packers with sports writer Mark Beach, who is responsible for the People's Team, an illustrated history of the Green Bay Packers. And even for Packer fans, you are bound to learn a lot from this fascinating book. And on Friday, Jessica DeBoer joins us to talk about the latest season of Fine Arts at First. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus.